a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Welcome to Senate Taxation. We're going to be picking up where we had left off the previous day. Do welcome everybody here, the internet listeners. Would also ask everybody to check your phones, make sure that they're shut off so we are not disturbed. And make sure that everybody that will be testifying that they do sign in. And we will have the secretary. Would you call the roll?
Senators Ewing.
Here.
Jones. Kirkaby.
Here.
Omdahl.
Here.
Welke.
Here.
Monroe.
Here.
Cotton.
Here.
Quorum present.
We have a quorum. And the minutes from last meeting. Everybody would have a motion to approve those. Mr. Senator Omdahl.
One second.
All righty, with that all being said, we will go back and pick it up where we had left off.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andy Gerlach, Secretary of Revenue. Thank you for allowing us to come back for a few minutes to finish our briefing from last week and finish the tax roundup. If you remember, we had motor vehicles talk about their licensing, the fuel tax, and their plate renewal. Property and special taxes talked about property assessments and the taxes and the compliance checks that they undertake. Lottery talked about their operations and how they generate revenue to support the state of South Dakota. Business tax talked about licensing and then municipal and sales tax from the state level and also their education and outreach efforts. Bruce Christensen, our audit director, talked about how we select audits and then the process of how we go through to work with a taxpayer during an audit. After an audit's over, if there's any discrepancies or things that we don't agree on, the process that we go through to try to work that out. So with that and continuing on that theme, if a taxpayer does not agree with us, there's some legal ways that we can work with them through the Office of Hearing Examiners to try to come to some type of resolution. So with that, I'm going to have our Chief Legal Counsel, Andy Fergal, talk about his operation and what they do and how it works into Tally Payer and the Corner Grocery's potential issue with the Department of Revenue. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Andy.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Fergal, and I'm Chief Legal Counsel for the Department of Revenue. As you heard from the Secretary, there are occasions when taxpayers and people we service don't agree with us. I know that's hard to believe, but it does happen from time to time. As you heard earlier in the week, Corner Gas Station is required to hold several licenses to conduct its business with your home in your hometown. Some of the licenses that were described to you were the alcohol beverage licenses, the lottery licenses, sales and use tax licenses. Mr. Howdy Shell told you about how the alcoholic beverage license holders are subject to compliance checks by local law enforcement, and our audit director told you how we audit most businesses over time who hold sales and use tax licenses, and contractors, excise tax licenses, and who hold motor fuel marketer licenses and the like. All these licenses are subject to revocation, suspension, cancellation, or non-renewal if the department finds that the corner gas station is not following the rules required to hold the license as set by this body, the legislature. If the department moves to revoke, suspend, cancel, or non-renew, Corner Gas in this instance would have a right to a due process hearing and may request an administrative hearing before the secretary. And that hearing is held by the Office of Hearing Examiners. After they make a proposed decision, that decision would come back more times than not to the Secretary of Revenue to make a final decision. If that final decision is a decision that is against the taxpayer, that taxpayer then has a right to appeal that decision to the circuit court. And after the circuit court proceedings, if the taxpayer is still in disagreement with the outcome, they have a right to appeal that decision all the way to the Supreme Court. And the legal staff with the department sees that case through from initial administrative appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. The same process is followed for instance, if Corner Gas was confronted by local law enforcement with a compliance check and they fail, and the department was to administer a penalty for that failure, a civil penalty, Corner Gas would have a right to administrative hearing, and that same process would be followed where they could appeal administratively. If they don't like the decision there, they could appeal to the circuit court. If they don't like the circuit court's decision, they could appeal to the Supreme Court. Again, as to audits, that same process is followed. If a taxpayer believes that we are asking too much of them, that we are incorrect in the application of the law as to the tax we are asking them to pay, they have a right to due process, and they can have an administrative hearing and appeal that matter all the way to the Supreme Court. So that's all I have to offer today. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them at this point.
Mr. Fergo, do you have any percentage of complaints over how many individuals that you're dealing with that you'd have for us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't give you any percentage, but I would say a vast majority of the taxpayers out there do not appeal the processes or the outcomes that the department determines. For instance, if we assess a civil penalty against somebody for not complying with or not passing a compliance check, most of those people do not appeal. If taxpayers' sales or use tax license is being revoked, I would say 99% of those people don't appeal, because the only question is, in those instances, have you been filing and have you paid? And most taxpayers know, no, I do have a business and I am doing business and I have not filed and I have not paid. So usually when we issue those revocation suspensions and cancellations or non-renewals, the businesses have been contacted by department personnel numerous times in order to try to make sure they're in compliance. And so when we finally reach this step, they know that they're out of compliance and there is usually not an appeal.
Out of those groups then that do appeal and take it in, is it normally for the state, or what percentage of those actually have their...
We do usually win, Mr. Chairman, but occasionally we do lose. So I couldn't give you a percentage of our win percentage per se, but most of the time we win.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Monroe?
Thank you. during the process of this administrative appeal, okay, so the police raid Mr. Joe's store on the corner, and they decide to appeal. Does that serve an injunction against that action, or are they shut down until however long it takes for the state to get done with their appeals, and at the state's convenience, then they open it up later if they by chance lose, or if it's remedied fast, whatever the situation is, or they just shut them down and say, okay, there you go, I'll start your appeal process, and in the meantime, starve to death, just, you know. This is going to be a real situation, I would think.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Senator Monroe, for compliance checks, at least alcohol compliance checks, a business needs to fail that three times within a certain amount of time. I think it's a two-year period in order for there to be a suspension or revocation of the license. So most times the business is not looking at being closed down. If the department was going to suspend or revoke the license where, in fact, they would not be open to sell alcohol, and they and the, say, this in this instance, Corner Gas, ask for an administrative hearing, the request, the timely request for an administrative hearing stays any action that the department could take. So they get to stay open until that matter is resolved, unless there was an emergency suspension for some reason, which would be require very serious types of violations for that to occur, where they would be immediately shut down and then have to wait for the hearing to see if they could reopen or not. Any other questions? Did I answer your question?
Thank you. So that means they're not shut down at the time of the sting or the time of the inspection of the restaurant or the time of the... Are you just saying they get a lot of warning before and then they're shut down? But during the hearing, they're still open or they're shut down during the appeal?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
No, they are not shut down the second that the violation occurs. And if they fail a compliance check, they stay open. And if for some reason it would be the third time within 2 years and the department was looking to revoke their license because of that, or say the local jurisdiction was, then if they ask for their administrative hearing or the due process hearing timely, they would get to stay open pending the outcome of the appeal. So no, they are not shut down.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Fergal.
Thank you. Next up is Larry Eliason, then, with Executive Secretary of the South Dakota Commission of Gaming.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As Mr. Fergal said, I'm Larry Eliason, Executive Secretary of the South Dakota Commission on Gaming. And we're a little bit different than the other agencies that have come before you, because the other agencies have contact with citizens throughout the state in every county and in every community. We regulate the two horse tracks, one at Fort Pierce, the Stanley County Fairgrounds, and one at Brown County Fairgrounds. We also have what's called an advanced deposit wagering hub in Sioux Falls, two what are called OTVs, walk-in pari-mutuel facilities where you can walk in and bet a race in California and New York. Those are located in North Sioux City and Rapid City. And then, of course, our main priority, our biggest workload, is the regulation of the commercial casinos in Deadwood. And there are some differences between how you regulate gaming, casino gaming. I've got a little illustration up here. The differences between racetrack gambling and casino gambling. I'll let you read the cartoon. And that's funny, but it's also it illustrates a point, and that is that at the racetrack or at the pari-mutuel, the bettors are not participants. They're sitting in the grandstand or they're watching on TV. In the casinos, the bettors are the participants. If you walk through a casino, the bettors are they're playing the machines, they're playing the card games, and those folks are not licensed. So it does present some regulatory challenges, and we're going to be coming to you with a separate bill to hopefully address part of that, and we'll talk to that bill at the appropriate time and in the appropriate forum. We talked about CaliPayer, and if you recall, the receipt that was shown for her different purchases and the different sales taxes, we ascertained that she was in peer at that transaction. What we didn't ascertain at the last appearance was that she was in peer on a Saturday in April. And she was in Pierre on her way to Deadwood. So she stopped at the racetrack at Fort Pierre on Saturday afternoon in April, and she put a bet down there, and that was taxed at 4.5%, and that's included in the cost of the ticket. The bet's $2, not $2.09. We also tax, of course, the OTBs and the
and the hubs. That revenue is by law earmarked for the Commission on Gaming to pass on to the live tracks at Fort Perry and Aberdeen for them to use for racing operations and purses. That revenue was down, consistent with the national trends in parimutuel racing being down. Those numbers were down about 25% from 2013 to 2012. When our friendly taxpayer gets out to Deadwood, she plays the slot machines, and there is a 9% tax on not on her bet. If she puts a dollar in a slot machine, she puts in a dollar, not a dollar and 9 cents. The 9 cents is figured. The 9% is figured not on the bet like it was at the racetrack, but on how much the casino ends up winning from her. Where there's also a $2,000 per device, that's per slot machine or per table, imposed each year. And those taxes total about half and half. Last year, the gaming tax, the 9%, was 56% of what we received in taxes and fees, and the device fee was 44%. So they're close to an even source of revenue. Of that 9%, 1% goes directly to the state general fund. That was a change in the law a couple of years ago, in the rounds administration. The other taxes are distributed according to two different formulas in the state law. The city of Deadwood receives most of that money. Tourism, the Department of Tourism, is in line, and then the general fund. And then there are smaller amounts that are distributed to Lawrence County, to the other cities besides Deadwood in Lawrence County, to the school districts in Lawrence County, and $35,000, up to $35,000, goes to Department of Social Services for them to make available to grants for treatment facilities, counseling facilities to deal with problem gambling, folks with problem gambling addictions. And $100,000 by statute goes to the Historic Preservation Fund that the folks over at the Cultural Heritage Center administer to historic preservation buildings around the state. Just this week, they announced four grants of $16,000 each to the Brown County Courthouse, the Bank of Iroquois Building, the Sioux Falls Quartzite Paver Alley, and to a historic barn in the Woonsocket area. They make those distributions, as I recall, twice a year, but those are handled through the State Historic Preservation Office. With that, I'd stand by for any questions.
Mr. Leisen, do you see any growth in this industry in the next years, and then compared to other states, how are we rating?
Well, let me take the first one, the first question. I don't see in the next, in the immediate horizon, any growth. In fact, the Deadwood revenue is down about 3.25% calendar year to date. Deadwood is a tourist community. The revenue there cycles. Certainly August is Deadwood's biggest month because of the close proximity of the motorcycle rally in Sturgis. We get a lot of customers from there. We also, can be victims of storms. I mean, that Storm Atlas in October, as I think everybody knows here, hit the western side of the state really hard. And there are some people that are still recovering from that. What some of the operators tell me is that their words are the ranchers just aren't coming to town. So I think we're still feeling the after effects of that. I always say that Deadwood likes a good storm. They like a good heavy snow on Thursday so that by Friday the highway department's plowed everybody out and there's plenty of snow for the snowmobilers and the skiers on the weekend.
One last one. Is this area of gambling, is this more age-related than, are younger folks getting involved in this, or is this something for that older folks would be involved with?
I don't have any statistical studies that I can tell you. I mean, just my own observation of being in the casinos in Deadwood, and whenever I get to Deadwood, I try to walk up and down the street and just go in and out of the casinos. I think, probably an older crowd. Generally speaking, you see a lot of buses of retirees, particularly in what they call the shoulder season, but between after the kids have gone back to school and families can't take summer vacations, but before the winter gets in, they get a lot of senior citizen buses. But they're also, you'll see, bachelor party groups. The young guys come to town, six or eight guys come to town, and they play blackjack or play poker. We are seeing some of the usually younger men from the North Dakota oil fields. You know, they've got a lot of disposable income, and they'll come down for some 2 or 3 day weekends, and that's usually a younger crowd. I think of course, it's a minimum of 21, and I think it probably covers from 21 to, you know, to 80, 85, but probably probably a little tilted toward the older demographics. Senator Jones probably has got a better handle on that than I do.
Senator Jones?
Mr. Eliason, how are you?
Hi.
Any thoughts? I know there's buzz out there, and I know the future is going to move to online gaming. So any thoughts on that, or preparation, or how the department would be impacted by that?
Well, we're monitoring that. It certainly is a buzz. That's if you had the time and the money, you could go to an internet gambling conference somewhere in the country every other week. The three states, I believe, Delaware, New Jersey, and Illinois, I think, have started legalizing intrastate internet gambling. There's a lot of talk in Congress about federal legislation. Nationally, the big boys in the industry, the Nevada casinos, are split on that. Most of the members of the American Gaming Association tend to be supportive of legalization and regulation. The AGA has recently shifted their position. They were in favor of a federal regulatory scheme. They have now changed their position that it should be legalized and regulated on a state-by-state basis. But also, you have the gentleman who owns the Sands, is very outspoken in his opposition to internet gambling, and has hired his own team of lobbyists, essentially to lobby against his own industry lobbyists. So it's a hot topic. We have not adopted any regulations for internet gambling, because at this point, at least, it would have to be intrastate, and we just simply don't have the population in South Dakota to make it work. There is some discussion about having some interstate compacts. In fact, I was just at a conference from a group called National Conference of Legislators from Gaming States, where that was a very hot topic. There is a difference of opinion among the lawyers involved if that type of compact would need, if two or three states did sign. There's a difference of legal opinion whether or not those compacts would require federal approval. There's also, frankly, some resistance by the bigger states like Nevada to say, well, we've already got, you know, millions of people. Why should we let a little state in on our action? So it's a very dynamic topic at this point, and I don't think it's really gelled yet.
Follow up. Just a quick follow up. Yeah, I've heard some of the same concerns. I was just curious how much you knew with the federal legislation and how that's going to be dictated. I think at some point, I mean, it's going to be equal from Deadwood or the tribes, that the platform for gaming is going to change in the near future. So there's going to be some kind of transition. I'm not saying the brick and mortar places are going to go away, but I do think there's going to be some type of transition process.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with the senator's comment that I think this is going to change. Gaming is a very technologically driven industry, and one of the things that we struggle with as regulators is just the time that it takes to promulgate a rule is to keep our rules current with the technology that the gaming companies, the manufacturers, are coming up with. to follow up on Senator Jones's comment, it's my understanding that most of the nationally known gaming, like Caesars and some of these places, have already reserved websites with their logo or their brand name on it.
Senator Dromdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eliason, has there ever been a plan, or has there been a plan to figure the cost, we'll say law enforcement versus counseling and administrative, versus the benefits of all of our gambling? I'm wondering, is there a way to quantify that, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that there has been any study to quantify it. I think everybody involved in the industry understands that some people are compulsive gamblers and they have a problem. And those problems have costs, social costs and law enforcement costs. As far as a dollar per person, I've never seen a study that put a dollar value on it. I have seen some studies where particularly in emerging jurisdictions, where new casinos were built, not surprisingly, that things like DUI arrests and bad check charges, those kinds of criminal offenses in that county or the next county have gone up. But I don't know that anybody has ever put a dollar value to say that a person with a gambling compulsion costs X dollars.
Thank you. I've got another follow up. What's the most profitable? Is it video? Is it Powerball? And what do we take out of those? I guess as a state.
Mr. Chairman, as to the video lottery and Powerball, that's not under the commission. The Commission on Gaming. The Deadwood casinos, as I said, were taxed. We tax them 9% on the win. If a customer, statistically speaking, if a customer puts $100 in a slot machine, they or some other customer is going to get $90 back. The house is going to keep $10, and we impose a 9% tax on the $10 that's kept, not on the $100 that went in, on the $10 that the house keeps, plus the $2,000 per machine. As far as the video lottery and Powerball, I'd have to defer to some other people in the room. I don't have those numbers.
Well, I got one more question. I guess an assumption, but during a biker rally, is that when most activity takes place, or is it cyclical, or in gaming, I guess?
Mr. Chairman? The revenues in Deadwood, and we track it by month. The revenues in Deadwood essentially are a bell curve, with the peak being in August, July and August, and then it tapers, it tapers down. There's a little, again, depending on the weather, if the weather cooperates, there's a little bit of a flicker in December, because Deadwood is a very popular place to go for, first of all, for New Year's Eve. That's a big night in Deadwood. And also, a lot of companies make arrangements to have company parties, company Christmas parties there. But it's essentially a bell curve peaking in August.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you very much.
With that, I'll go back to my racing analogy, and I'll hand the reins of this horse to the secretary to get us to the finish line.
Thank you, Mr. Elias and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I've never seen as much anxiety prior to today and yesterday with the taxation committees in Larry Eliason's face and words. He has never in his career in state government appeared before the taxation committee. And last week when I told him he had to, he was very anxious, not in a positive way. So congratulations on that. Just to wrap it up, gentlemen, and just a couple of comments I would like to follow up on. And you heard about the lottery and gaming, And I thought it was good to bring that before the taxation committee. I'm going to associate myself with Senator Jones's comments in terms of, you know, we run lottery and gaming like a business, and we have to. And we have to look at trends, business trends, demographic trends, who is playing, who's not, what do they want to play. And, Senator, I know that you're very familiar with this. And next week, we are going to brief both of the Commerce Committees on our video lottery strategic plan. And quite frankly, after the smoking ban, and there's other things, too, we've seen a downturn in video lottery revenue. And Senator Amdahl, we take in about $90 million a year into the state budget in video lottery revenue, and that's a 50-50 split with our partners. That's down from about $120 million in the peak years of 2007 and 8. But I would be remiss if I would say it's all with the smoking ban. I think we compete for the dollar and the entertainment dollar of everyone, as I think Larry and the Deadwood casinos do. And I think that is becoming more challenging all the time. And we've taken it, like I said, serious enough to hire a consultant that spent time in this state last year visiting a lot of our video lottery establishments, visiting tribal casinos, visiting Deadwood casinos, visiting Larchwood in Sioux City, where you're going to have a new Hard Rock casino that's going to get under construction to replace their Riverboat casino potentially in the next year. So when we look at taxation, when part of our job is to generate revenue for the state of South Dakota, gaming, no matter where you come out on it socially, is an important part of what we do. And we are taking it serious in the department with the lottery. And I know Mayor Turbeville and our gaming commission and Larry's folks take it serious in Deadwood to try to continue to make that a viable source of revenue. So it's an interesting topic evolving. And again, I think the key is how do you continue to attract a new generation, younger generation that may want a game? And then what kind of games do you offer them to make them interested in it? So something we're thinking about very much. We get about, from the instant and online, when you look at Powerball, I think from our Powerball sales, we get about $8 million a year, and then we get about $5 million a year from our scratch tickets, where if you go to the convenience store like Tally Payer did and buy one, I think we generate about $5 million off of that. Is it? Do I have those turned around, Norm, or is that correct?
Yeah. Fiscal year 13.
If you'd come to the mic.
I'm sorry.
For our internet listeners.
Good morning. Norm Lingle, Executive Director of the South Dakota Lottery. For fiscal year 13, net revenue from scratch tickets was about $5.6 million. From the lotto-style games was about $10.4 million. And then in video lottery, it was about $91.7 million for a total of right around $108 million generated from the lottery.
Thank you.
I'm going to comment on two more things before we leave, and I know it's areas that that you hear about and know that we deal with. We also work very closely with the tribes in this state, of which the nine that we do work with. We have eight tax collection agreements with the tribes where we work with the tribe and their local businesses to generate or they generate the tax revenue for individuals that run and utilize their enterprises, both stores and other areas. And then through the tax collection agreement, we do a split based on the census of tribal versus non-tribal that utilize that. And then we send the tribal portion of that back to the tribe, and then the state keeps the non-tribal portion of that. So very proud of that and the relationships that we do have with the tribes. Likewise, we also have gaming compacts with eight out of the nine tribes in South Dakota. The only one, we don't have one with is Cheyenne River, and they do not have a casino there. So it's an important part of what we do and what, you know, we have in South Dakota and in our tribal relations through those two aspects is something that we take very seriously. So the last thing that I wanted to visit with you about, you see things in Congress and at the federal level related to taxation. South Dakota has been a longtime member of the Streamline Sales Tax Project, started in and around 2000 or the late 90s, to try to have some type of standardization from state to state in terms of taxation. And we think it's a benefit for business to do that. We meet, we look at issues, we decide how we want to, as a group, tax things from state to state. Right now, I believe there's 27 states that are full members and then a handful that are associate members. So we really study tax policy, not only in South Dakota, but in every state, to try to have some type of standardization to help business. In relation to that, you may have seen and heard about the Marketplace Fairness Act. Marketplace Fairness Act is an initiative at the federal level to allow states to tax transactions that actually happen in their state by individuals through e-commerce. So an example is, if someone in South Dakota, any community, would buy something from Amazon, when they receive that, they should pay the tax based on where they're located, and that would be a use tax. However, we know that that doesn't always happen, and our estimates are that the state of South Dakota loses upwards of about $60 million a year, both at the state and municipal level, to online transactions that take place and use tax not being remitted. And we're not unique. Every state suffers from this. So the Marketplace Fairness Act is a bill in Congress to allow states to license businesses that do not operate in their state and then garner taxes based on online transactions and online commerce. So it passed the Senate and the House, or it passed the Senate and Congress. It's in the House right now. I hope it has a hearing sometime soon. It did have quite a bit of momentum going into last fall, and I hope they take that up and discuss and debate it. Obviously, the large companies, Amazon, and a lot of the large retailers do not want to have that happen because they think it's going to be another burden for their businesses. So that's something, as the tax committee, to keep your eye on. If you see things in the paper or hear about the Marketplace Fairness Act, that would be something that South Dakota would benefit from. And again, as you look at transactions that continue to increase over the internet, and the way of doing business over the internet increasing into the future, we think that the taxation policy, both at the federal and then state level, should keep up with that. So wanted to just bring a couple things up outside of the roundup to you, because I know as the tax committee, you're interested in all things related to tax like that. So with that, again, thank you for the opportunity to appear the last couple days in your committee, Mr. Chair. I hope that our brief was informative, not only about the department, but really dug down into some things that we see in tax in South Dakota. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee or any of our staff to address issues that you would like to.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Kirby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one. Last year, we passed a little legislation. I'm not sure within that time frame if you've had the opportunity to review and evaluate the benefits of the bingo bill that Senator Amdahl carried last year. I have no serious question, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that. Are there any other questions from the committee? With not seeing none, I do thank the Department of Revenue for your time, your graciousness today, and for yesterday especially. With that, is there any motion to adjourn? And Senator Amdahl, and then Jones. And let's have a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? We do stand adjourned.